Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, welcome back.
Hi, Mark. How are you? It's been a couple of weeks.
It has. I realize you've been doing some traveling.
I have. I did a marathon last week. I did 4 countries in 9 days.
Ooh, that is a lot.
Yeah, I was tired of airports, I can tell you.
And I'm sure across all those airports, you did get the necessary 26.2 miles for a marathon. So you're good to go.
Yes, but one of the interesting things is when you do travel abroad and you speak with a lot of investors and agents and people and lawyers as well, you realize how little people know of U.S. laws and how much people make up.
I can see that, as well as things keep changing. So what they may have known for certainty 4 or 5, 10 years ago could be changed today or tomorrow.
Right. But the other thing is, in some countries, there's a lot of emphasis, so a lot of trust on brokers and middle people, which really is not correct at all. But there's, unfortunately, it's part of the tradition in some countries.
So Mona, 4 countries, 9 days, did you focus specifically on EB5?
Well, EB5 obviously was one of the center points, as well as direct foreign investment, Mark. But interestingly, we had a lot of questions and a lot of interest in alternative visas, one of them being the topic of today's show, L1 and EB1Cs.
And we also have Rebecca there to talk about it as well, right?
Yes. Hi, Mark. It's been a while, but I'm back on here.
It has.
So I'm going to go ahead and let's start right away. I'll tell everyone about the L1. As many know, it's also called the intracompany transferee visa. It's a non-immigrant visa. So what it means is that it's a temporary visa. Meaning when we say intracompany transferee, what does this mean? It means that overseas companies are able to transfer their employees to a new or existing company in the U.S., which is very beneficial. It helps companies to get started up here, or, you know, if they have their companies already set up and they could be multinational companies, or it could range to small business owners.
It's a pretty common visa, mm-hmm. though, right?
Yeah, it's very common. It's along with the E2s, so this is another popular visa.
There's a difference also, Rebecca, between the two types of L1s, right? L1A and L1B?
Yes. So what I'll do first, I explain a bit more about the L1. So the requirements are that you must have a corporate relation between the foreign company and the U.S. company. That means you could have a parent, a subsidiary, affiliate, or a branch, and you must continue to share common ownership or control. And the other requirement is that the employee must have worked for the foreign company 1 year out of the last 3 years. So now, difference between an L1A and an L1B. L1A is a managerial and executive position. Now, you can come in here for a maximum of 7 years under the L1A.
Is that able to be extended?
No, unfortunately. So initially, if you come in under an existing business, you'll get a 3-year visa, and then you can extend it in 2-year increments. If it's a new company, you'll obtain a visa for 1 year first. And then after that, it will apply to renew for every 2 years. It's a strict visa. You need to be very detailed in your description. You need to say your position and your duties. I'm sure we'll discuss this more later on as well. And your supervisory role. The L1B is based on your specialized knowledge. You can only get that for a maximum of 5 years. You need to have knowledge of the company's products and services, and that should also be detailed. Attorneys should know that. And once you've completed your maximum time, which again was 5 years, you can apply for a new application. However, you do still have to go back out of the country and work 1 year with the foreign company before applying again.
One of the interesting things, though, about an L1, Mark, you may perhaps not realize this, but when we often talk about E2s, there's only certain countries which are allowed E2s. one of the things about L1s is that there's no restriction on a country.
Exactly. So there's no country restrictions, nor is there a visa quota. So that's why it's become very popular.
Well, I think it's also popular because it is one way of going forward for a green card too.
Exactly.
But the L1 itself isn't a green card, right?
No, unfortunately, it's not. But as we said, it can lead you in. Before I start into that, just to let you know, under the L1 category, you can include your dependents, your spouse and children under 21, and a spouse can also obtain a work authorization. There's dual intent as well. And then premium processing, you can get your application can be adjudicated within 15 days. So what is very helpful is that there's also no set minimum investment amount, but we're also going to get into that as well, the implications of the investment amount. But as Mona mentioned, this can lead into a green card, and I'm going to have Mona take it away with EB1C.
Right. Well, I wanted to introduce the EB1C because we have a special guest here, Mark, today, who's going to help elaborate a bit more on the EB1Cs, because it's the EB1C which is becoming so popular in countries like, for example, China. And one of the main reasons is because of course, retrogression of EB5 and the idea that a business person can set up a business here and then move forward and get their green card without having to go through the whole EB5 process of keep putting your money in a project and possibly losing it and the delays, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to get more into the EB1C green card with our special guest, but just because people get really, really confused with all this, I just want to explain one thing. The term EB. EB is employment based. So you have different categories. You have EB1, which EB1A and B would be for scientists, people of high caliber, extraordinary ability. Then you have the EB1C, and the EB1C are senior staff of executive level or top managerial level. Then you have EB2s, which is a skilled worker, EB3, so unskilled worker. EB4 are special visas for people like religious workers, domestic abuse, abuse spouses, and then, of course, EB5. So those are the basic five categories of the EB. So this being EB1, one of the other huge, 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 huge advantages is that you don't really require any sponsors for an EB1. And the timeline for you getting a green card is super fast because you can accelerate it by doing an expedited petition, and you can have an expedited petition adjudicated in 3 to 4 weeks. So getting a green card in this amount of time with no quotas is huge. And that's, again, one of the reasons why this has become very popular. To discuss this further, Mark, I really want to bring on board somebody who's very knowledgeable and specialized in putting together petitions, or he can recognize rather all of the stuff for EB1Cs.
That's right, Mona. Today we have Andrew Chapin. Andrew is the founder of Plan Immigration and PI Business Brokers, where he advises clients on investment and business strategies that offer pathways to residence and citizenship in the United States. He's a registered investment advisor, business broker, holds a couple of master's degrees, as well as a PhD in economics. Andrew was born in Germany and has lived in several countries, but 20 years ago, he immigrated from Switzerland to the U.S. on an L1 visa. So I can see why he's the perfect guest to talk with today on this topic. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you. As you can imagine, I love L1 dearly for many years, and it's very close to my heart.
It makes all the difference, Andrew, when you actually have been through it yourself. I do understand.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, I'm a financial person, so I will not be talking about legal aspect because Mona covered it, and I will talk about money, and I will talk about business. That's kind of my specialty.
Yeah. Well, sorry, Andrew. And there's a number of myths, Andrew, that I really want to displace here, and you're the best person to discuss all of this. So anyway, why don't you tell everybody about your experience, though, in the industry?
Oh, my experience in the industry. So I have personal experience, and since 2009, I am actively working with business owners from all around the world who wants to move to the United States. And over the time, I accumulated a lot of experience, and basically it's like every little details is based on some mistakes or some problems that my clients experience. That's why when I will be talking about some aspects of L1A And EB1C, I will be talking based on the acquired experience over the years working with the business owners from all over the world.
You know, that is the best way to learn. Nobody learns from textbooks, unfortunately. We all learn from USCIS RFEs.
RFEs, exactly.
That's true. So I would probably start with the first misconception and the first question that a lot of business owners are asking is, do I need to buy or establish company in the United States and doing basically the same what I'm doing right now? And the question and the answer is no. You can do in the United States whatever you want. For example, I was doing financial advising in Switzerland, and I immigrated investing into the nurse placement company. And as you can see, it worked. So from my personal experience, I can assure you that you can do anything that is legal in the United States, and it does not need to be connected to what you're doing right now. So that's very important.
That is important, Andrew, because a lot of people try to pigeonhole businesses. What business they have overseas, they try to pigeonhole that here.
Yes, absolutely correct. So that's extremely important. So we are talking about the businesses that from one point meet kind of person background. For example, I have a French person who was managing a trucking company, and he loves to work with people. And here he is, will be managing painting companies that have a lot of employees too. Like, you know, kind of this type of connection. It's not really obvious from the very beginning, but it's allows a person to show his skills and apply them in the best way.
I just had a question with, as you were saying, with the trucking company, with the foreign company, and then the company here in the U.S., what is the relationship that they have, the foreign company and the company in the U.S.?
Or they need to be, it's more like legal questions. They need to be either subsidiary or it's with the same business owner, owned 100% in the foreign company and 100% in the company in U.S., it's kind of branch of the foreign company. So there is a several arrangement can be done.
Right. But what Andrew is basically saying is that the business does not have to be the same.
The same.
Mm-hmm. Right. A very, very important point. That's like, you need to point it out from the very beginning.
So Andrew, another issue which happens, and we're hearing it a lot, as well as the, you know, the type of company, we hear this a lot from not only from China, but also from India, that people think that they can go and get a green card this route by saving a lot of money. They don't have to put in the amount of money they would for an EB-5. Perhaps they could set up for the 150 or 200 and then be able to go forward and do an EB-1C and get a green card.
It's actually the next point that I want to, to discuss. It's I will call it L1A trap. It's there is no defined amount by U.S. immigration how much money need to be invested by the foreign companies. So unofficially, it's around $100,000-$150,000. So compared to EB-5, it's kind of cheaper. You can go and establish an office and you are totally fine. So it looks like it's much cheaper. But after that, arises a question when the client calling attorney and saying, I'm ready for the green card. And attorney responding, so how many employees do you have? I have two. And attorney will say, no, we cannot do that. Two employees is not enough. So here we're seeing how being cheaper, so to speak, initially. After that, the new company get into the trap that they have two options. Either to grow the business as fast as possible and have 10 employees in 2, 3, 4 years. That is really, really difficult in the realities of American economy. Or to go and buy the company to increase number of employees, but it needs to be the company at the same industry that initial office was established. So that's a little bit difficult too, because you need to geographically, this business need to be close, and this business need to make some economic sense, financially profitable, and it should be in the same industry, and it should be affordable in terms of the price.
Sorry, Andrew, I was just going to cut in a little bit here. You know, Andrew, that's a common theme throughout all of business immigration. We feel that is something common for E2s, for EB5s, for L1s. And Mark, one of the reasons we asked Andrew on the show is because he's not a lawyer. He's not looking at the immigration side of it. He's looking at the business aspect.
Right. I can see that. And that way, he has a very good feel, not just have gone through the process himself through the L1, but is working with other clients, what the feeling is of them on the business and financial impact versus, you know, what's strictly needed on the legal sense of the petition. You know, what is the actual cash flow impact to these people?
That's right.
Yes. Yeah, so when the people look in that, if they don't want to immigrate or apply for EB1C later on, the path of establishing office and start the business is really perfect. But if they want to later on to apply for EB1C to the green card, so to speak, there is a big difference in between L1A and EB1C. L1A can be approved with one or two employees. Mm-hmm. EB1C can be approved with five professional people or 10 plus employees if it's include like labor and some engineers and some managers. And if you think about that, it's five professional people with college degrees. In order to accommodate their salaries, you need to invest more than $100,000, $150,000. You need to invest $400,000, $600,000, $800,000, or even $1 million to satisfy requirements that the business can employ that number of, let's say, professional people, five professional people, or 10. Let's say you buy in the restaurant or establish in the restaurant. It's like 10 people, 15 people right there. So you cannot do that with the amount of $100,000 to $150,000. And that's what I call L1A trap. People establish an office with $100,000. They get approved for L1. And after that, they don't have economic foundations to apply for EB1C.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's very, very difficult from a business point of view to grow business that fast, to have 10, 15, 20 employees like in a period of time of 2-3 years when the client will approach immigration attorney and say, I am ready. But his business is not. That's a common
yeah.
thing.
Andrew, that actually goes along with under EB1C, you can't apply right away if your business is new, actually. You have to at least wait a year before applying for EB1C. So, and even then, a year doesn't seem enough. It seems that you need to have, you know, 2-3 good years behind you.
Well, that's if you're an L1, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Andrew, do you have experience of people who have not done an L1 and come in and perhaps have a senior position at a business and have applied directly for an EB1C?
Oh, absolutely. The tandem L1A EB1C is existed because immigration kind of, there is a urban legend that immigration likes to have first L1A and after EB1C. But in reality, you can go straight to EB1C and bypass L1A. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah.
And how you can do that? The answer is very simple. The company that you are buying should be substantial in terms of number of employees, revenues, and profit. You cannot go for the small company, and you cannot mm-hmm. start the business because it's very difficult to grow the business, as we talked before. So mm-hmm. the only one way to go straight to EB1C is basically to purchase existing business with a history, with number of employees, with a good revenues, establish clients base. That's the way to go straight to EB1C.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, we've also experienced clients who've wanted to do an EB1C without any background experience. And we found that USCIS have looked, unlike EB5, where they do not look at any previous experience, for EB1Cs, they do look at it.
Yes, because it's kind of called international manager. And if the
right.
person has
exactly.
no experience, it's very difficult to call them. So in this case, we would recommend just to go 1 year or two or three just to run the business, on L1A first, and after that apply for EB1C. And it's also even less risky just to go to EB1C and to buy the business, or L1A and to buy the business. Because at the beginning, when you buy in the business, you can sign conditional contract to purchase. And only one condition is visa approval. So your money is staying in escrow till the visa will be approved, and visa will be approved is going from the escrow dispersed to the seller of the company. So this way, it's our client is on the safe side, so to speak. He's not spending money. The money is on escrow, and he's just waiting for the contract to be approved.
Yes, but Andrew, I found that those type of cases where you keep the money in escrow, again, are very difficult because USCIS like to see more certainty, and they would like to see if the business is a substantial size, for example. It's very difficult to do that without spending any money, with keeping everything in escrow. Because, for example, you might need a lease, so therefore nobody's going to give you a document for a lease without putting down some money as a deposit.
Oh, yes. So you need to establish first a company, company to sign the lease. Lease used to be a very big problem. We have a situation when the owner of the building asking for 6 months security deposit, 12-month security deposit. We need some U.S. citizen or some prominent company co-signer on that. Fortunately, lately we have a solution for that. It's called shared offices. Mm. And shared offices are not so demanding in terms of security deposit because the same space is, so to speak, leased to many entities. And so their risk is very small. So they're very happy to sign any lease with 1 month security deposit. So that's kind of, help us a lot lately with this new development in real estate business.
Right, but the problem is with the shared leases is the square footage. Mm-hmm. If, for example, you have a business where you want 8 or 9 employees, then you have to get a much bigger lease.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We are talking about the company that is prepared to acquire some business. So we kind of showing some commitment of that business and show that money is in escrow, that company was incorporated, that will acquire the business. And they have an office, and office is not small right now because it's only accommodate owner and maybe some consultant who are waiting for the visa to get approved and purchase the business.
I have one question. You've mentioned the EB1 trap where you have to put in basically a lot of money to be able to pay for 5 professional salaries or, 10 other employees, which is more than what most people may initially think to start or buy a company. But what I'm also hearing is that EB1 can purchase an existing company and retain those existing jobs where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Mona, normally we talk about EB5, and that's typically, new ventures and new projects and creates jobs. So is that another differentiating point between EB1C and EB5? Is that EB1C you can go at and just buy an operating business that perhaps meets these employment requirements? Granted, I understand it may be the same amount of money, perhaps even more, but it would be essentially a turnkey business. And Andrew, as a business broker, maybe you have experience with this.
Yes, but actually you can buy the existing business on L1A and EB1C. They are all allowed to do that. So you don't need to L1A to establish a business. You can buy substantial business on L1A. And one of the reasons people doing it, it's they will see quick result, quick approval from United States Immigration Office. So the family can move immediately to United States. And after that, they will take some time to apply for EB1C. But if the business is substantial, I have cases of electric contractor company and a couple of others who apply for EB1C 3 months later after being approved for L1A. So it really depends on the size of the business. But in terms of if you need to establish business on L1A, buy the business on EB1C, no, you can buy business on L1A and EB1C. The trap is that when they establish small business in L1A for $100,000, and later on, they will try to apply for EB1C, they will never be approved because they don't have scale of business, number of employees, revenues, so all these attributes of their substantial business.
Right. And just to answer your question, Mark, you can acquire an existing business in EB5. However, you, once acquired, you must create 10 new permanent jobs, full-time permanent jobs. There isn't any, you know, you're not precluded from acquiring a new business, but it's the job creation which really puts EB5 aside from EB1C.
Yeah, and to go along with that, so there's no actual minimum job requirement for L1, but as Andrew was saying, that the whole point of you going in to become EB1C is that you're under a managerial or executive position. So how can you be a manager or an executive if there's no, if you're not supervising anyone?
Right. Andrew, I'm not sure if you're seeing this, but what we are seeing from petitions from China, for example, is that people who are investing money and they're purchasing a business, we have to spend some considerable time sourcing the funds.
Yes, because technically the money should be transferring from the parent company to the subsidiary or branch in the United States. And the first transfer can be very small, relatively small. It's 30,000 and it's called startup money. And it should be go directly from a company account in China, let's say, to the company account in the United States. And after that, it's getting to the area that not a single company keeping like that amount of cash, let's say $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 on their account in the normal type of operation. That's usually money that's already owner took from the business and holded it somewhere else. And that can be like issue because they are holding, especially in the countries like China and everything, in very interesting way sometimes.
Oh, so Andrew, we're going to go in a little bit about the pitfalls here. One of the questions I have or that we see here is the foreign company. You know, everyone forgets about the foreign company once you come into the U.S., but it's something that's very important. You have to make sure the foreign company is still up and running.
Oh, yes. So that's one of the perceptions that the minute you will have company in the United States, you can neglect your business. No, the owner actually will be in a position, figure here, figure there. So owner can live in the United States and visit his Chinese, in terms of if it's Chinese national, Chinese companies, or he can reside in China and visit his U.S. company. But in reality, he needs to travel constantly between these two businesses because he needs to keep them running.
Right. And another major pitfall of doing an EB1C is the corporate structure, because you still have to maintain the corporate structure that you had previously when you were under your L1.
Yes, but fortunately, it's a very fast, it's a 1 year waiting time approximately right now, as far as I know. I may be mistaken on EB1C, so it's 1 year when he actively need to keep the structure in business.
Right.
Well, I know we normally explore topics within the EB5 realm on this show, which is why I'm glad that we took a moment to talk about the L1 and the EB1C and the different ways that you could go into an L1 and evolve it into an EB1C, some pitfalls, and even how it contrasts to the EB5 program that we so oftenly talk about on the show. Well, Andrew Chapin, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.